What trends and technologies should you be paying attention to today? Are there hot new database servers you should check out? Or will that just be a flash in the pan? I love these forward-looking episodes, and this one is super fun. I've put together an amazing panel, Gina Huska, Enos Montani, Richard Campbell, and Calvin Hendricks Parker. We dive into the recent Stack Overflow developer survey results as a sounding board for our thoughts on rising and falling trends in Python in the broader developer space. This is Talk Python to Me, episode 504, recorded April 9th, 2025.
Are you ready for your host? Here he is.
You're listening to Michael Kennedy on Talk Python to Me, live from Portland, Oregon, and this segment was made with Python.
Welcome to Talk Python to Me, a weekly podcast on Python. This is your host, Michael Kennedy. Follow me on Mastodon, where I'm at mkennedy, and follow the podcast using at Talk Python. Both accounts over at fostodon.org, and keep up with the show and listen to over 9 years of episodes at talkpython.fm. If you want to be part of our live episodes, you can find the live streams over on YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube channel over at talkpython.fm/YouTube and get notified about upcoming shows. This episode is brought to you by NordLayer. NordLayer is a toggle-ready network security platform built for modern businesses. It combines VPN, access control, and threat protection in one easy-to-use platform. Visit talkpython.fm/NordLayer and remember to use the code talkpython-10. And it's brought to you by Auth0. Auth0 is an easy-to-implement, adaptable authentication and authorization platform. Think easy user logins, social sign-on, multi-factor authentication, and robust role-based access control. With over 30 SDKs and quick starts, Auth0 scales with your product at every stage. Get 25,000 monthly active users for free at talkpython.fm/auth0. Hello, everyone. Enos, Gina, Richard, and Calvin. Welcome back to the show, all of you. It's great to have you all here.
Yay.
Thanks. Yay. Hi.
Yeah, really good to have you all here. It's been fun to have you all on separately for different shows. Although, Gina, you've definitely been on a few panel shows before recently on, I think the last one maybe was our Mastodon one, right? We talked about that. Yep. That was a lot of fun. Today, we're going to talk about developer trends in a general sense. And I invited you all because I, like all of you, really appreciate having you here. And thanks for taking the time to be here. But you all also kind of work in little bits of different spaces of technology and interests and so on. So I think we'll get a really nice, diverse perspective of experiences and so on. I think the AI section is going to be especially interesting, as we'll see. Where are we going with that? That's always interesting. So what we're going to do is we're going to use the 2024 Stack Overflow developer survey results. It's a little bit old, but it's less than a year old. I think it's close enough to use as a skeleton to kind of make that conversation happen. So it's going to be a ton of fun to just have a wide-ranging exploration of how people are learning technology, using technology, which ones they're using, so on. Before that, though, let's just do a quick round of introductions, and we'll go around the Brady Bunch squares in order, I suppose. So Enos, you're in the top left. Welcome. Great to see you.
Yeah, nice to be back. Yeah, I'm Enos. I'm the co-founder of Explosion. We're probably most well-known for Spacey, which is an open source library for natural language processing in Python. So everything to do with text, AI, I do a lot in the open source space, and also helping developers build their own AI models in-house, taking back control, that sort of stuff. So yeah, very, very curious. Like, it was quite hard not to look at the results beforehand, but I did it.
Thank you. Yeah. And we recently talked about open source and LLMs and AI and stuff. And will open source or the big cloud companies dominate that? That was a lot of fun to talk about.
Yeah. The AI revolution won't be monopolized.
Yes, right? Exactly. That was great. Gina, hello. Welcome.
Hi. My name is Gina. I'm also known as Foozle. And my claim to fame is probably Octoprint, which is the snappy web interface for your 3D printer, which is actually written in Python, which in turn is probably why I am here. I happen to be a full-time maintainer working on that project and have been doing that now for well over 12 years. So yeah, it's a weird life, but it works somehow.
It's kind of an amazing life. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are seeing that as the dream, right? You created an open source project and it's successful enough that you can do that full time. That's
That is a dream.
Yeah, I mean, the people who are now listening to this instead of watching that will not see it when I point to my head, though, and show all the gray hair that is up on there. That wasn't there when I started this. So just pointing that out. Hey, there are downsides to this, absolutely.
Just correlation, you know, not necessarily the same, right?
It's who knows? Things up, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know how that goes. Hey, Richard, good to see you.
Good to see you too, friend. Richard Campbell, I make the podcast .NET Rocks, Run As Radio, and now part of Windows Weekly as well. I'm supposed to be a happy, you know, .NET person, but as GitHub loves to remind me, write entirely too much Python. That's and right. YAML. Why do I write so much YAML? I don't know. Anyway.
What kind of life choices have you made?
I don't, you know what? I munge a lot of data these days. I don't know if you know this, but Python's pretty good at that.
Yeah.
So, you know, my Jupyter notebooks open most of the time. Because there's always some chunk of data I need to rip through.
There's some surprisingly good tools. I was just talking with Reuven Lerner about Pandas stuff. And what you can do in a couple lines of code is ridiculous.
You know, MapReduce used to be this huge task where I harnessed multiple machines to try and, you know, actually crush a large amount of data in a reasonable length of time. A contemporary PC is really good at it. Stuff has changed. It's only getting easier, and you know, use the tools du jour and you'll find you'll get good results in less time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you have a bunch of great podcasts. People, those sounds interesting too.
And whenever I get to talk to you, it's usually one of the geek outs, right? Like that's where we end up though.
So. Yeah, yeah. We've done some great geek outs, some life in the solar system and energy talks and so on.
Yeah. The nuclear power topic these days has been really huge because everybody's talking about it. And turns out I did a bunch of stuff on that back before it was cool. And so people keep asking me to do more.
Yeah, that's very, very neat. Calvin, hello, hello. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too, Michael. I'm Calvin Hendricks Parker. I'm CTO and co-founder of 6 Feet Up, where we are a Python and AI for good organization. Lifelong Pythonista. I chose Python back in the year 2000 and decided I never wanted to look back. And so I made a company around building cool Python stuff for other folks. So I guess that's kind of my claim to fame. This year will be my 21st PyCon. So my PyCon attendance can now drink.
We always have the best parties together. And some of the highlights are all the get-togethers that we do.
Yeah, getting the people together. That's what's important.
Yeah, you should all come to Europe. PyCon DE is later this month. I'm very excited. It's going to be cooler than ever. Oh, and you're present as well. But I think the PyCons and PyCon Italy is also very good. PyData, Amsterdam, like, I don't want to single out too many individual conferences, but like, you should totally
come to Germany. You've got favorites, I hear it in your voice.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Sounds like events you need to bring your stunt liver to, though.
Yeah, no, Calvin, I definitely think definitely have been hosting some of the great parties, the after parties and stuff at PyCon. So,
well, I love the community. That's probably why I'm here, is because I'm definitely a community first type person.
Yeah, beautiful. All right. Well, with that, let's just go ahead and jump right in to the topics here. So like I said, what we're going to do is we're going to go through the Stack Overflow survey and just kind of use it as something to riff off of. So the first portion of Stack Overflow, of course, I'll put that in the link in the show notes. You can check it out and follow along. It had 65,000 people participate. That's a lot of people. I don't feel like Stack Overflow almost could have got more, but that's still, you know, statistically pretty significant. And Stack Overflow, I think it's pretty broad across all the technologies these days. Although I think Python is still the number one language on Stack Overflow.
Yep.
If we were to check out
maybe
Stack Overflow. Yeah, Stack Overflow trends. If we look at...
I mean, some might argue that's because Python is the number one language for developers.
I'm just saying that I think the results will be pretty significantly include a significant amount of Python feedback, not just overall for better and worse. This portion of Talk Python to Me is brought to you by NordLayer. NordLayer is a toggle-ready network security platform for modern businesses. It combines VPN, access control, and threat protection in one easy-to-use platform. There's no hardware or complex setup, just secure connections and full control in less than 10 minutes. It's easy to start with quick deployment, step-by-step onboarding, and 24/7 support. It's easy to combine. It works with existing setups in all major platforms, and it's easy to scale. Add users, features, and servers in just a few clicks, single sign-on and provisioning included. NordLayer provides zero-trust network access-based solutions. It adds threat protection to keep malware, ransomware, and phishing from reaching your endpoints. It increases your threat intelligence to spot threats before they escalate, and it helps businesses achieve compliance. So if you're responsible for the security of your software or data science team, you should definitely give NordLayer a look. As TalkPython listeners, you'll get an exclusive offer up to 22% off NordLayer's yearly plans, plus an additional 10% off the top with our coupon. Just use the code TalkPython-10. That's TalkPython-10, all lowercase. Try NordLayer risk-free with their 14-day money-back guarantee. Visit talkpython.fm/NordLayer to get started. That's talkpython.fm/NordLayer. The link is in your podcast player's show notes. Thank you to NordLayer for supporting TalkPython to me. Yeah, so right now, if you look at it, we've got Python at the number one, and we've got JS as number two. Yeah, but boy, oh boy, there's a really precipitous drop in 2023, and we'll come back to that. That's going to be super interesting. But that's section three of our conversation right there. So the first thing that comes up here is education. How much education have you had as a person who works here? And then I think maybe it's probably most relevant to focus in on the professional developers. They break out all respondents versus students versus professionals and so on. So let's do a quick round here. You know, how much programming did you all learn in school versus how much did you teach yourself?
None. In school.
Okay. Like, yeah, tell us about it.
I mean, I didn't, but also, computer science. No.
What did you study?
Communication science, media science, and linguistics. Because, you know, when I was like trying to decide what to do for university, it was weird because I didn't really feel like a programmer. I was always programming on the side, but like, you know, I thought of programmers and it was like boys from the computer club. There was no one really, you know, also being a young woman, like there was not really any role model or like idea, like, hey, I'm actually a programmer too. So,
absolutely. Yeah, we talked about how your linguistics experience brought you into NLP stuff, which got you into programming, right?
I mean, I did a tiny bit of Perl in university, but like, I'm not really counting that. And also, everything we were doing there, I kind of already knew from, I don't know, just hacking around myself.
Sure. Who else? Who else wants to share?
I think everyone majored in here. Like, I was computer graphics technology. I took an engineering course in C and an engineering course in Fortran, but I wouldn't call that a computer science background.
No. Interesting, but not a computer science background. Gina?
I actually have, what is now a master's degree equivalent in computer science. For me, I also grew up programming and figuring that that was the most amazing thing ever. And then I learned that it was an actual job, and that was when I knew what I wanted to become. But to this day, I say I didn't learn much programming or anything like that at university. I learned tolerance towards frustration and stress management. But all of the programming stuff is actually mostly self-taught, I would say. Because also, I mean, we did some assembler stuff and some really weird old stuff at university. Also some Java, which later became my main job before I went into the whole maintainer with Python situation. But I think it's more been a case of lifelong self-teaching and trying to stay up with things that are happening and learning new languages here and there and such.
Yeah, it's not like engineering or something where it's kind of stable. You know, bridges are still bridges. Stuff is changing fast. You got to stay on top of it. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Richard. What's your background, actually? Oh, Michael, sorry.
I'm pretty close to where you are, Enos, as well. Like, I was in school for a long time. I love school, but I studied math and chemistry, mostly math. And I only did just enough programming to do the research projects I was on, which was very, very little until the very end. And then I'm like, you know what? I kind of like this better. What am I going to do to like keep doing this? Because it seems like the job opportunities are way better and it's much more interesting. So yeah, I'm definitely on the self-taught train.
Yeah, that's me. But it's really my father. He was an electrical engineer and designed electronic cash registers. So I started programming cash registers when I was 8. And
the original point of sale. Amazing.
Yeah, from the very beginning. And then when the TRS-80 Model 1 shipped in 1977, I was in the Radio Shack for the next year. Because that was the only thing I was interested in, for a whole 4K of RAM. And
amazing.
So I did, then my first you know, part-time job after school was repairing TRS-80s for a company called H&S Microsystems. I've never done anything else.
Yeah.
So by the time I graduated high school, I did my last 2 years of high school living on my own, making a living as a programmer. So I didn't go to university. I was too busy working.
Well, I think it paid off for you. I think it turned out all right.
Yeah, it did okay. Yeah, but, okay. I have the advantage of being first. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember
amazing.
Reading the specifications of the IBM PC before it was released and going 640K of RAM. Who's going to need that?
Yeah, that's way more than you're ever going to need. All right. So what does Stack Overflow say? It says that about 75% of the people have a bachelor's or a master's degree, but only a little under, where is that number again? School, a little under 50%, just under 50% of the people actually are using school to become software developers. Then, you know, pretty much all of us here are in some way or other having to keep up with this technology and libraries and so on our own. And so the next one asks, like, what online resources are you using? And so maybe just we can go around real quick. It's like, where are you all spending your time? And I'll start first. Probably YouTube for me, with, you know, other blogs and other things thrown in, but YouTube is a big portion where I like learn new things and keep up with stuff.
I'm a reader, you know.
Yeah.
Like it's the fastest mechanism for me. I prefer to read my documentation is at the pace that I can read it at and then test stuff out. I like YouTube. It's just too slow.
Yeah. See, I'm a slow
it's
reader.
You say that, so. Because I was also like my problem with YouTube is like there are so many people on YouTube and they all speak they speak too slowly. And yes, you can like make it faster and it's just, but yeah, I have a very similar feeling and it's, it makes me happy to see also on the Stack Overflow stats to see documentation be so significant and also to hear it come up again, because, you know, I've always put so much work into our documentation and I've always been really passionate about documentation and sometimes I wonder, hey, do people actually read this? How much does it really matter? And so it's nice to see that it seems to matter.
I mean, what you don't see on this list is podcasts, because who would learn from a podcast?
Who would? Oh my gosh. No.
Like there, auditory material at the bottom.
There you
8%.
Go.
I used to not think YouTube was important. I was also in the same boat of like, this is too slow. Why are people spending this time? I feel like that's my disconnected, my brain recreational learning is on YouTube, but like my real like hardcore learning is probably more blogs and docs.
Yeah, when I want to learn some new language or something, then I go with written things, actually like books. Shocking, I know, but but when it's like making skills like binding or whatnot, then it's certainly YouTube, because then it helps to actually see people do that by hand. It doesn't help me watch someone else code. It helps me to read the documentation and understand how things fit together and click through some library things and such. But I don't know. This trend towards everything needs to be a YouTube video that goes like 15 minutes and 10 of those are please sponsor me and such is something I don't understand, but maybe I'm too
old. Smashing the bell and all that.
Yeah.
I'm surprised AI is so low on the list, because that seems like that pair programming, I'm going to do it together while some AI explains something to me, is pretty effective. Like I've seen my kids use that.
And I wonder if that's just a timing thing, right? Like that was a year ago.
Yeah, so it was a year ago. You're right.
Those two, you know, the ChatGPT revolution starts in 23. Like it's not been a lot of time. And yeah,
forever.
I'm now in the insider version of VS Code with that build with Claude and like, wow, that thing's a really great tutorial tool. Mm-hmm. But that's only been in the past couple of months.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, time's flying.
I'm guessing like AI here, they mean, you know, a chatbot type interface. Like, I mean, I know I keep complaining about this and it's maybe pedantic, but like, I'm like, AI already has this terminology problem. And I feel like, why do you need to call it AI? AI means so many things. And it's like, you know, half of these things have AI in them. And like, what do you mean? Be more explicit, because I think it's actually in for so many things, including how we think about open source software regulation and so on. It's actually a huge issue that we do not distinguish between products like chatbot products and software components, for example, and call everything AI. And I think ultimately the people that benefit from it most are big tech companies. So I feel like we should stop doing that. So I'm a bit mildly annoyed at Stack Overflow for just calling it AI.
Yeah, I can probably fix it. Let me just right-click inspect.
But in some ways, it's become the new agile, right? It's like it's a word so overloaded and it doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah. We're using agile. It just means we stop writing down the waterfall.
There you go.
Now, I know, Richard, you have an interesting take on a lot of the stuff. Like, things are AI until
I always use it. Remember that AI is a marketing term for raising money, right? Marvin Minsky coins it in the 1950s to get money out of the U.S. military, which, by the way, worked. But inevitably, once a technology works, it gets a new name, right? It becomes image recognition or large language models. So as long as it's called AI, you know it doesn't work.
It's still looking for its place in the world.
Yeah. You'll get a new name.
All right. So out on the Stack Overflow survey, technical documentation is the number one. 84% of the people say that they do that. Not surprisingly, number two is Stack Overflow, but like it's a self-selecting group. So there's that.
Yeah.
Tutorials, blogs, how-to videos. I mean, I just want to thank you all. Thank you, everyone, for making me feel weird and being the only one who said YouTube here. But
sorry.
No, I'm just teasing. Seriously, for me, when I'm trying to learn, this mostly goes for like frameworks. Like if I want to learn a UA framework or I don't know, seeing it built up as sort of as somebody's like, let me talk you through or show you how I'd build this, like sort of start to end. That really sticks with me better than reading documentation. And once I see that, then I'll go to the documentation and to AI and like, okay, help me click the pieces together. Anyway, that's my world.
It's proof you have lots of screen space, right? That you have your coding window open in one spot. Then you got the YouTube video up in the top right. And then you've got the doc down the bottom right. So you can work your
way. Now that you say it, like it is not actually, it takes some of it back, what I said earlier, because also we did some videos. I did some YouTube end-to-end tutorials and they did quite well. And I still have people to this day come up to me, ask me when I'm doing my next video, say that they've really enjoyed them. So there is an audience for it.
Yeah.
So
which
reminds me, I should do another YouTube video. I have like the script ready. I'm really bad at actually recording.
And I have a Pluralsight subscription that comes with, you know, one of the influencer packages. So I tend to go there. So it's not like I don't consume video. It's just not YouTube.
So during the pandemic, I had a couple of sessions where I actually just streamed myself while working on Octoprint and explaining my thought process. And that is something that I felt was helping those people a lot who didn't have much development experience at all and were just trying to understand, so here's a problem. How would someone who has done this before approach this problem? Reduce it into several parts and then approach every single part and the thought cycles that are involved and so on. For something like that, I think a video is great. But if it's something like technology, like how do I program a command line thingy in Go, for example, that is not something where I would watch a YouTube video for, but like rather look up code snippets and then try it on my own. So maybe that's also a thing, because you said you want to you basically want to move through the process with the developer. So maybe that is that kind of approach more, where you are trying to wrap your head around what is possible and how can I solve this specific problem versus going into a deep dive into the API or something like that and just figuring out things that way.
Yeah, I think so. For me, I like to kind of learn. I want a sort of a surface layer experience of it. Then I'll want to go a little deeper, then a little deeper, instead of trying to like, anyway. This portion of Talk Python to Me is brought to you by Auth0. Do you struggle with authentication? Sure, you can start with usernames and passwords, but what about single sign-on, social auth, integration with AI agents? It can quickly become a major time sink, and rarely is authentication your core business. It's just table stakes that you got to get right before you can move on to building your actual product. That's why you should consider Auth0. Auth0 is an easy-to-implement, adaptable authentication and authorization platform. Think easy user logins, social sign-on, multi-factor authentication, and robust role-based access control. With over 30 different SDKs and quick starts, Auth0 scales with your product at every stage. Auth0 lets you implement secure authentication and authorization for your preferred deployment environment, you can use all of your favorite tools and frameworks, whether it's Flask, Django, FastAPI, or something else, to manage user logins, roles, and permissions. Leave authentication to Auth0 so that you can start focusing on the features your users will love. Auth0's latest innovation, Auth for Gen AI, which is now available in developer preview. Secure your agentic apps and integrate with the Gen AI ecosystem using features like user authentication for AI agents, Token Vault, async authorization, and FGA for RAG. So if you're a Python developer or data scientist looking for an easy and powerful way to secure your applications, get started now with up to 25,000 monthly active users for free at talkpython.fm/auth0. That's talkpython.fm/auth0. The link is in your podcast player's show notes. Thank you to Auth0 for supporting the show. Let's talk experience. Now, I know everyone on this call, we're all pretty young, but we probably have at least 5 years of experience doing this stuff. No, I know. We've been doing it for a while. Take. Really quick, numbers of your programming, top to bottom, Ines, roughly?
Oh, depends. How do you count? Like, really professionally and doing this job, it's like, it's over 10 years. I did, you know, start writing my first websites 24 years ago. But like, mm-hmm. that was, you know, that's like, I don't know. I would never say like, oh, I started programming when I was 11 and that's how much experience sure. No, I have. Obviously
yeah,
not.
No, professional.
Like really in this job and everything, like really doing what I do, like a bit over 10 years.
Awesome.
First line of code.
Professionally.
Professionally would be 25-ish years ago. In general, 35-ish.
Yeah.
Something like that. So.
Yeah. Awesome. Richard?
Well. Yeah. I mean, I was, when do you get paid? Right. So I was being paid for code in my teens. So 40 years.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. 27 years for me.
I was going to say 27 for me as well. I think. Jinx.
Yeah, awesome. I feel for these people who are in the 1 to 4 year like range. This is a really, I think it's a tough time for those folks.
Yeah. But also there's a lot of people still joining the industry. Like this 25 to 30% constant add going into the industry means we're always going to skew young effectively.
Or like early in the, programming journey, because, you know, I think actually speaking of trends, like what we see, I think in, especially in AI or in like, you know, out the machine learning field, like the most successful projects are those where people upskill and subject matter mm-hmm. experts who are like maybe experts in finance, in some other area, pick up the tools. Because, you know, it's never been easier to learn programming and solve a problem. And I think there we might have people who are actually quite established in their career, but only recently learned programming. And I think that's an interesting trend. And I think with everything and the way it's going in the field, I think we'll see a lot more of that.
Yeah. But is this survey biased that we've got younger folks maybe replying than older folks on the list too?
But what I find interesting is this big jump there. From like we are starting at less than a year with 5.5%, and then suddenly we spike up to 1 to 4 years with 27.3%, and then the curve ebbs down again until we are at 0.1.
The less than 1 year is because they don't find Stack Overflow.
Right? Exactly.
That is what I'm taking from that. Yeah. So like, if you're in the 1 to 4 bracket, you are constantly on Stack Overflow, and if you are earlier than that, then you are not yet. You haven't yet discovered this.
Certainly my experience consulting into teams is the majority of the developers on a given team are under 10 years of experience and they have a senior that's over 10 years.
I would say as well. And just to give you another perspective. So the people listening, it's the biggest category is 1 to 4 years, 27%. And then 5 to 9 is, you know, another 25. So over 50% in there. But most importantly, it's the 1 to 4 years, I believe. We need to like keep that in mind. Now, you could say Stack Overflow is skewing this because people are just hammering on Stack Overflow and trying to figure out what to do when they're brand new. But the PSF JetBrains survey, which didn't have anything to do with a code help site like Stack Overflow, I think 40% were less than 3 years. 40% of the people doing Python have been doing it less, 3 years or less. And so it's I think this is a more broad trend, which is something we got to keep in mind when we're building libraries, building products, doing tutorials and so on, is that a good chunk of your audience will be like, everyone knows what a virtual environment is. Everyone knows what async is. Like, no, they don't.
I take, back, I take back part of that, like, feeling for those 1 to 4 year people is that they also didn't get to experience Python 2. So they only know the beauty that is Python 3. And...
their will has not been crushed. They have optimism in their life. Yeah. So they
much less the migration, right?
Or like writing Python 2 and 3 compatible code.
Don't stop. You're bringing back the nightmares and the headaches.
What were you saying about gray hair, Gina?
Python 2 to 3. At least half of that is from that.
Now, on the JavaScript side, now it's relatively hard to find folks that experience Angular 1.1 and the chaos that was moving to 2, right? Like, that's now passed. So, in that sense, new developers coming in, they get to benefit from the fact that they're getting into stabler tools with the, you know, robust solutions. There's a lot less experimentation, depending on where you're going. I mean, there's nobody with 10 years experience with an LLM, so... you know, everybody's a beginner there.
Yeah. They'll still be able to experience some packaging grief somewhere along the line.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, depends on how
you define LLM. Doesn't matter how long you've been doing this, deployment sucks.
Yeah.
People call everything an LLM now. So, you know, in theory, I can go around and claim I have 10 years experience in LLMs because, you know, relatively large language models.
Yeah, you probably all have heard the joke, but I imagine many listeners haven't, that Sebastian from Fast API.
Oh, yeah.
Put out there. He said, I just saw a job posting. You know, he created Fast API, right? And this is 2 years into it existing. So I just saw a job posting asking for 4 years of experience with Fast API. He's like, I created it and I only have 2 years experience with it. I don't know who this is for. Hey, we all have 10 years of experience with AI. Amazing.
There you go.
All right. 10X. Yeah. Well, hey, if you're a 10X developer, you get 10 years of experience per year. I mean, come on. All right, let's talk technologies. And I don't know how you all feel about this sort of like, what is the most popular programming language? And again, focus on professional, but I feel there's a lot of things that are not comparable. And this one probably is the most. You'll have like SQL versus C++. You're like, these, I don't know, those are the same. Yeah, CSS versus C++, like not the same thing. They're not, anyway, that rant out of the way.
Well, obviously, they qualified their heading with putting in their markup languages.
Ah, okay. Okay. But Python and Java and C++ are in there. Mm-hmm. C++ is a hardcore markup language. Anyway.
So what was the original question?
It's just for making scripts.
The original question here, let me just give people a quick bit of numbers. JavaScript is number one, which they put up as JS, 64%. SQL is number two at 54%. HTML, CSS, which again are not the same thing, but 52%. And then Py, which I assume stands for Python, is 46%. Then TS for TypeScript. But then like longer words like PowerShell are written out. I don't know why some are abbreviated and some aren't. Nonetheless, that's kind of what it is. And the question is, which programming, scripting, and markup language have you done extensive development work over the past year? So this panel's fairly skewed, but just maybe give me your perspective on where you see energy going to these days, different languages. Like, for example, in Python, we've seen a lot of people move to Rust, even though most people are still doing Python and so on.
Yeah, and most is a relative concept. Rust is still, you know, at the edge of the long tail, so to speak. If you're looking,
Rust is super, super low. Actually, it's like 2% or something.
It's it's a pretty specialized space to live.
Yeah, it's 11 for Stack Overflow, but in the trends, I think it's the TOB index.
Speaking of trends, like one thing I would find interesting, can you click on learning to code? Like it would be interesting because they did separate it out. It'd be interesting to see people who are learning, what are they learning maybe?
Right.
I mean, they didn't ask specifically what are you learning, but like extensive development. And there we have Python at the top.
Yeah,
so
by quite a bit.
And HTML, okay, I get that. HTML, CSS, like everyone's putting together stuff on the web. You know, maybe, I don't know if everyone read the question correctly. And like really thought about extensive development. Like maybe people thought, everyone's hacking. I don't know. I'm sure most people who develop hack around with CSS or with HTML a bit every year. Yeah,
like, unavoidably.
Yeah.
But so
I'm not surprised.
If you gather all the web technologies together,
it's
a webby world.
If you're making a web app, like you have a lot of different languages and markup languages you're interacting with, which you don't necessarily have in Python. Python, you write Python, like maybe if you're a library developer, you do some C or Rust, but that's kind of it. Whereas, okay, if you're a web developer, you do HTML, CSS, JavaScript, TypeScript all together. You might do some database stuff as well. You might do Bash script. Like, there's just this huge pile of technologies that come with a certain job, and we just mostly have one.
Yeah, but most Python people are writing a little SQL too. You got to get your data from somewhere.
Well, but you can have someone else do that. You can, you know, use an existing API. Like, I'm sure I would. I know, like, I don't really write SQL, to be honest. And I think I would know a lot of, also I like to call it SQL, but that's a different story. But I know a lot of developers, I'm sure, who don't write SQL.
I don't write SQL, might not even know it.
No. What's SQL?
Oh, just
it's called SQL. You
know, I honestly, when I'm talking to databases, I use ORMs and ODMs most of the time.
Yeah.
I know, Richard, you're a big database guy, so that's...
I've been everywhere for one time or another. So SQL is certainly a friendly language to me. And apparently, according to the professional developer side, lots of people are touching it, right? Yeah, and I presume that each respondent checked multiple boxes, because we rarely actually live in one language. You usually have to go spend time elsewhere.
Do you read the learning to code as like, that's aspirational? They wish they were doing Python.
Yeah, did they ask that question this year? Because they used to ask that, right? In the developer survey, like what do you wish you were writing?
Yes, that I believe that's in the most loved and most hated and most wanted. I don't know if that's in here. Actually, let's go down to
we find out.
They might have stopped doing that as well.
Yeah.
Gosh, because I
there's an admired and desired
that.
Section in 2.2.
Okay. Let's see. Admired and desired. Yeah, there it is. Okay. This is pretty interesting. Yeah. What do the bars mean here, folks?
No. Okay. Admired versus desired, right?
Yeah.
So I admire Python, but I don't actually want to do it. Okay.
So admired is red. That's like, I think this is like a borderline contest. I mean, no offense to Stack Overflow, but that's like a borderline contestant for the data is ugly subreddit. because I find this quite hard to read. But again, no offense to anyone. It was just people who made this, and I don't want to be a dick about it.
Why not green? Like, I agree.
Can someone decipher this for me? Because I actually don't understand what I'm looking at here right now.
Let me describe it here. So there's a, if you go to the section, if you go to the section, there's two bars. There's like kind of an error bar looking thing with two numbers. Mm-hmm. And it has a range on the blue one on the left is how desired is it? And then there's a red one that shows how admired it is. And you can see the delta, the gap between how much it's wanted versus how much people like admire it. So Rust is probably
Elixir,
the biggest.
Elixir makes the sense to me, right? Because Elixir is really not easy to work in, but it's beautiful when it works. So it makes perfect sense to me that almost nobody's doing it, but everybody thinks it's cool.
Yeah. 77% think it's cool. 5% are doing it. Or actually want to do it.
Yeah, no, that seems that resonates with me. I get that, right? Like that would make sense.
So here we have Python number one, both in absolutely number one and desired, not number one and admired, which is pretty interesting. It's still quite high up there, but there are things like Rust, which is more admired, and Zig, which is wild, and even Elixir, as you point out there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think this represents trends pretty well.
Yeah, and when you're talking about admired, it's like, who are the cool people that are talking about this? Like, how much did this number move for Rust because Racinovich was all over it?
Yeah. And in Python, we've got a bunch of tools that have come along, especially from the Astral folks, but others, where we've seen huge benefits because people have written in Rust. And I don't know if that's how much of that is we've just put better algorithms into it and how much of it's actually Rust, but it is Rust nonetheless. And I think that puts a lot of shine on it, but people are said still rather just write Python, but it seems impressive or cool, and I think that kind of gets captured here.
Yeah, I think definitely sometimes people ask us, and if we were to like rewrite Spacey, say from scratch, we might probably we still use Cython, but maybe we would have also used Rust. Like, it totally wasn't a thing back then, but I think if the alternatives are just, you know, C++ or or Cython, which isn't very extensively documented, so I can see by Rust is like, it's nice and attractive.
Yeah, quite interesting. All right, I want to cover one more from this section, and then we need to make sure that we save a little bit of time for the AI category, because that's certainly going to be a thing. And that is cloud platforms. So one of the things I find really interesting is how much the big three hyperscale clouds, AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud, to dominate where people are working, right?
Which I don't know how often developers make a decision in this space.
Yeah, you certainly have talked to a lot of larger companies that have like really big cloud deployments. Mm-hmm. Give us your thoughts.
Any more than most developers choose what database you're using. Like somebody else selected that product and pays for the licenses for it, and you are going to consume it.
Yeah.
I will say, of the ones that are on this list, I feel like AWS is the most developer-centric or friendly. Like, I would consider Azure being like infrastructure ops friendly, and AWS being like, oh, they're going to throw out a lot more developer-y type things.
Okay. I mean, we've had a lot of headaches. I mean, I'm not an infrastructure person, but I just know we did have some headaches with AWS, and Google Cloud is like what we ended up migrating to because it, it felt much more developer-friendly.
GCP is the most developer-friendly, but the corp doesn't necessarily like it when you get further afield with it. I think what AWS has been brilliant at is how they manage their startup relationships. You know, once you get to a certain size working with AWS, a tech shows up to help you. Like they've done a really good job of cultivating support there. Plus they are the reference name.
Yeah. And also cultivating like developers that specialize in it, because ultimately that's kind of how it works. You have like DevOps people. And if you do manage like, you know, significant infrastructure on any of these cloud platforms, you need a developer to do the maintenance on it. Like that's also something, you know, we've realized when we had to downscale some of our operations a bit. You know, like the infrastructure is set up so that it needs people to maintain it and so that it can do all of the things. And, you know, if the company encourages, you know, more people to specialize in its platform, then, you know, you also have more companies and hiring people to do it.
As you add up these numbers and say they don't add up to 100%, it's like, listen, as soon as you get to a certain size of an organization, you have more than one cloud in your life. Like it's just not optional.
Question, can we take a look at the split between professional developers and learning to code just out of curiosity?
I don't even know what I was doing over in that learning to code mix. That doesn't make any sense.
So that is what I would expect. Now learning to code, please.
So just for people listening, AWS 52%, Azure 30%, Google Cloud 25%.
On the pro developer side.
Oh, yeah,
and then when you flip to learning to code.
Google Cloud is number one at 24% learning code. But the split is way more distributed across all these little areas, which is interesting. Sure. At AWS, it's 20.
And when you talk about dev friendly, it's none of the big guys, right? Like Vercel and Firebase and Cloudflare.
Yeah.
And DigitalOcean even I would put up there. Much more dev-centric.
I also am a bit confused about like what do they define as cloud here? Because I would certainly put Amazon Web Services and Azure and stuff into a completely different bucket than a vServer hosted at Hetzner or at OVH. Mm-hmm. So that is a bit weird because, I mean, I might be missing something, but I think neither OVH nor Hetzner nor something like that do have an offering similar to AWS and such. So that's a bit of a mixed bag.
Like Hetzner has basically... It has cloud servers, it has cloud firewalls, and it has a beta version of S3 storage, and that's it.
Yeah, right? And you can also you can vertically scale and such. They have an API for scaling. Like I have all my stuff hosted there basically, but it's definitely not the same thing as all of this orchestration stuff that you can do with AWS, Azure, and such. Or even Cloudflare. So I think that's a bit of a mixed thing.
Clearly evidence that they asked developers this question, not the people actually owning
it. Yeah, but what percentage of the developers are using serverless-y things on Amazon and not just putting up EC2 instances with their stuff in it? Like that'd be an interesting.
Yeah. That would be a super interesting. Yeah.
Or who does web development? Because, you know, we have platforms there that I also use, like Vercel or Netlify, which is where we host our stuff, which, you know, if you're learning to build a website, that's the easiest way to just press play and you have a website running, but it might not be necessarily where you would even host a machine learning model. Although it's kind of, I think they're all trying to break into that field as well, but like it's I think it's very use case specific.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways to slice and dice this.
There's still developers coming up to terms with containers. And so they're not even in, you know, running containers that are in any environment.
Certainly in the Microsoft world, it's, you know.
I mean, mentally coming to terms with,
But the Microsoft world containers, because Windows containers are terrible, until you're at a place working in .NET where you're comfortable deploying onto a Linux instance, which, by the way, immediately saves you 20%, 25% on your cloud consumption, then containers work. And now you need to learn all of that as well. Although your AKS is your packaged Container services make that a lot easier. So folks don't have to learn it. They just deploy into a service.
Yeah, certainly in that space, a lot of people first have to learn Linux and then they can learn Docker or even VMs, right? It's really a big lift for a lot of folks that are just like, I have a GUI for my web server. Like, what?
Is there a container section on this survey? Did people talk about that?
Let's see. Although, no.
It falls into Docker is in other tools. Right?
Yeah, it's another tool. Okay. Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, I have all of my stuff running over at Hetzner as well.
I'm a massive fan. This makes me sad. This is just.
Yeah, it does make me sad. Okay. This is a year ago, but still. Yeah.
Still.
Yeah. I don't even know what. I just can't. It's so spread out all over the place.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I believe there's like, I don't know. There's things like pip and npm, but also Kubernetes, you know, like not really sure they're the same, or a Visual Studio solution, which is the file format for an application.
That's a tool. This is a grab bag of random words.
It is. Oh, we're just going to skip on. All right. We have just a little bit of time for the finale here. And I think I want to put the caveat out here as we talk about the AI section that one, there's a lot of hype. It's all over the place. It can mean different things to different people. Also, as we talked about at the beginning, this is a year old, and a year in AI years is probably like 10 years.
And I do worry about virtue signaling here too. Just like this is almost asking, do you recycle, right?
Yeah.
But I
break my glass in the backyard and just leave it there.
I did grab the 2023 numbers because they as well, just to compare these two, because I didn't follow the instructions. I'm badly behaved.
That's good.
And, you know, so the key number there, that 60%, and in 2023, it was 40%. And okay, in 2023, admittedly, GitHub Copilot at that point was already 3 years old. Like, we tend to think from ChatGPT forward, but GitHub Copilot came first, the original Copilot.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's been there, it feels like.
I really want to focus on the sentiment and sort of how you all are using this as to kind of close this out. However, or not using it, which is fine. But I do want to just put, there's a really interesting graph here. If you look at the Stack Overflow language trends, which show how many questions appear on Stack Overflow for that technology, there, you know, Python has had this meteoric growth, almost hockey stick, not quite, but almost until 2023.
Yeah.
Really. Like late 2022, right around November.
Is this graph really just showing the demise of Stack Overflow?
Yes. Yeah. If you look at this graph, there's a massive drop of Python there, but there's also a massive drop of JavaScript and some others as well, but certainly the most popular ones. And that is basically when ChatGPT came out. And that is a really interesting developer trend on its own right there.
Yeah. But I do think, to put this into perspective, also, are new questions on Stack Overflow a good thing? Like, that's, I think that's another, you know, yes, it looks like, oh, but I mean, yeah, maybe the people who would have otherwise opened a question that was already answered like 2 years ago, yeah, they found their answer on Stack on ChatGPT, and that's great. Like, you know, we don't need the internet to be flooded with like a lot of redundant information. Like, I know, to Stack Overflow,
You're hinting at the other aspect of it, which is getting progressively harder to add questions to Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
Question.
I think you're right, Ines. I think it's people are just going elsewhere. And that's kind of what I was thinking there.
Yeah, question, that graph just there, was that questions asked for that thing or search terms for that thing?
I believe.
Because it's a huge difference.
Over time, based on the, I think it's question ask, or maybe answers as well, but it's not search terms. It's
okay.
It's content, I believe, on there.
I just wanted to make sure. Okay.
And just in case people are worried that maybe it's crashing or something, you can look at the TOB. I can't type, and I know I spelled that, but you know what? We're gonna get that fixed. There we go. I mean, if you look at Python, it's still year over year up 6%. Which is not just faster. It's like three to six times fast. It is a blowout level of growth. And I think
all new dev. That's people coming in using a chat tool to learn programming, and it's really good at Python. Like, if you want to navigate, really VS Code with the free Copilot, teach me Python, you're gonna have a good experience.
Yeah. All right. With that that out of the way, what's your all sentiment personally for AI? And maybe how do you see people?
I love the 20% of that. No, and I don't plan to. I bet you they all skew older.
Yeah, that's probably true. Enos.
Yeah. What do you mean by AI?
You live AI somewhat you live in the ML space. I mean, you're kind of AI before AI. It's in, like legitimately. I guess. Yeah, I don't know what
you mean.
Is.
Generative. Think,
let's say
chat tools.
Let's say LLM. Yeah, let's say LLMs.
but like LLMs to that generate text for a human to read, because you can also use LLMs.
The question is, what tools do you use to as part of your development process, not as part of your API or for your app to run it, but what do you use to write code? Basically, let's go with that.
So I don't use many models a lot to like actually help me write code, because I think the stuff I do is like quite specialized and specific, or often, you know, it's like very specific things in like the libraries we're building, for example. But I do think to explain code to you or for workflows like infrastructure and stuff, that's where it's like really helpful. Or also, I know my co-founder, for example, he's done a bunch of quite complex infrastructure stuff, like setting things up with Terraform, and they're really having a model summarize and explain it to you. That is very helpful.
I've done things like explain this Docker Compose file to me. What does this line mean? I don't understand this. Does it mean if it fails, it'll restart, or if I should have done a restart? What does this do? You know, and it really is quite good at that. So interesting. Yeah. So not so much. You're not vibing. Let's put you as the non-vibing.
But I found out that actually, because we've always, I think I might have mentioned this before in another context, but like we've always put a lot of, in the libraries we write, a lot of work into all this backwards compatibility stuff, making sure we don't break users' code. And this actually had a very positive side effect, which is that these models are really good at writing, for example, spacey code. And it's never something we planned. We were just like, oh, we just want to do all the boring stuff right and make our users happy. But this really paid off. Like I've heard these models, Copilot, ChatGPT, are really good at writing code for our libraries.
And you were attributing that to good documentation, right?
And we always put a lot of work into our documentation. I think that might have added to that as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Gina, what do you think? I know you're not a super you're not an AI accelerist, let's say.
Let's say I consider myself an AI skeptical. The thing with me is when Copilot came out as a GitHub star, I had a very early access to it, and I started using it, and I allowed it to autocomplete a lot of my lines. I found it an amazing help in translating my stuff, because I write everything in Octoprint in English first, and then the whole UI needs to be translated to German on every release. And doing that by hand is a lot of work, and having the AI make suggestions is really nice in that case. And then AI started to get shoved into my face from every place all around me, and I read up on the energy consumption of that stuff and the water consumption of that stuff, and that they were thinking about firing up additional power thingies again just for that stuff. And that was when I decided, okay, I'm not going to use this anymore. I'm refusing to use this, and I have disabled Copilot and try to not touch anything AI if I can, simply because I don't like how it is getting pushed into everyone's throat these days, down everyone's throat these days. I actually do have a free account on ChatGPT. I sometimes have the problem that I forget words in English or in German that I can still remember how to describe. And then when I do not have anyone I can describe that to, I can describe it to ChatGPT, and then it tells me, oh, you did mean, I don't know, interface or something like that. And then I'm like, yay, exactly. And I'm happy. But other than that, I don't touch that with a 10-foot pole anymore, because simply it's just too much. I don't like hypes at all.
Yeah, but what do you mean it's generative models?
You are completely right, because I get this little shock every time that I am also into game development. And now every time that I read or watch a video about how to build some kind of AI for a game, my initial reaction is always AI. And then I realize, no, stop, that's the good type. That's the thing that makes the characters and NPCs walk around and such, and pathfinding and so and whatever, right? But yeah, I'm totally with you. I just suffer from the same problem, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. You're a very principled person. I definitely admire that about you. It's tough. I think I do hate having AI jammed into everywhere. Like my email client can rewrite stuff with the AI. And it almost never comes out the way I want. And when I do, LinkedIn, all the formatting is lost. I'm like, hey.
It's the worst.
Yes, I know.
And do you get comments like that where I'm like, I know exactly, like why do you want to encourage people to write these shitty comments on posts that add absolutely nothing and are essentially spam? Yeah.
Sorry. And that you then need another chat thingy to parse again in order to exactly. summarize them for that. That's like completely like, bye.
I know it. All right. Well, you don't have a ton of time left. I got to keep moving along here. All right. Richard, where are you on this?
Look, I'm talking to a lot of PMs and things who are saying my team is 25, 30% more productive using these tools. And they can see just more check-ins of more code with fewer remediations. Like what we saw in the first like 6 months of the team using it is more reverts because they were overcommitting with the code they didn't fully understand. But over time, they got better at it. And when they did check, when they actually got to the PR and merge, the code stuck. So there was a lot of fewer problems net to the point now where it's like, I kind of can't hire anybody if they're not using these tools because it's like they're not using an editor. Like the productivity level is substantial if they're in the workflow. And I noticed going further down the list of data here, like, that AI in the development workflow, they're using it for writing code, right? That's what it's doing. It's code completion and it's, describe the problem and it gives you a first gen and you can iterate a couple of times on it. But this is also a year ago, like the ability to write PR explanations and things was only just emerging when this survey was being done. Today, I notice everybody's PR explanations are wildly better. Because they didn't write I've them, the too. Tool did.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And also maybe as a bit of a positive outlook, like I do think we're already seeing that it's possible to use local models and use much smaller models, that you can actually run on your laptop and with the device constraints that you have. And it's like, it is a subset of, I think I was just reading something today about Visual Studio Code supporting more local models and adding more features for that. So I think because it's such a specific thing.
I feel like we're starting the right size now. That it's for the initial iterations of these products, we're throwing as much meat at them as possible because they weren't sure they were going to work. And now it's like, hey, too much is also a problem because it goes off on weird wandering and we've been able to narrow
and also I think models. Companies can have their own internal fine-tuned models as well, like something really small. Okay, that model just writes PR descriptions for our team that works in this field with Python. And then it's small. Everyone runs it locally. It's data private. You don't need to send your shit to GitHub, to Microsoft, to OpenAI. It's like it all stays internal and you have control over it. And I do think that would be a good compromise solve a lot of the problems. But of course, it's something that there are a lot of companies out there, especially very large companies, that do not like this kind of vision. And that's also why I'm so passionate about not calling everything AI, because ultimately, it really just benefits big tech who, likes having us throw chatbots and open source software into the same bucket and regulate it exactly the same way because...
Yeah. And this is the problem with the hype cycle is as you go, following Gartner's pattern into the trough of disillusionment, you do end up with dumb regulations to respond to social concerns rather than thoughtful, here are the different problems and how we can scope them more.
And lobbied by companies like, OpenAI, for example.
The incumbents want to lock in their advantage.
Where's our regulatory capture, please? We need to work that into the various places. All right, Calvin.
Well, for folks who know me, they probably know that I'm an eternal optimist, and I'm definitely... very excited about the AI developer tools. I'm actually giving a talk on it like next week at IndiePy about this because there's so many good options out there. Now, that said, I feel like these tools definitely benefit the senior coders more than they do the junior coders. Like, I feel like this whole, every time I hear the word vibe coding, I shudder kind of like Gina does around anything that says AI. So I think there's a great potential for a lot of tech debt to be produced very, very quickly with those kinds of tools. And I feel like under poor guidance or poor mentorship, there's a lot of damage that could be done. But the upside is so good, kind of like Richard. Like we're probably only going to hire somebody who is basically augmenting their personal skills with a set of tools behind them that make them perform at a higher level, just in general. Like there's so much upside to it. And I do love the local tools. Like I run Mistral Small and Llama 3.3, all that stuff locally. And so nothing's going off my laptop to interoperate with a lot of my tooling. There's so many good open source options too. I know a lot of people are excited about like Cloud Code and Copilot, but the Aider chats, the Goose clients, those things are really incredible and they're open source. They all run local. I want to jump on the terminology bandwagon. They're agentic, another terrible abused word that everyone's they're using. But the tools like Goose and Aider will run commands locally on your machine as a proxy to figure out things. And I love that capability that is now doing that introspection, exploration, understanding. You know, it's really a great usage of the reasoning models, and being able to use multiple models simultaneously against a code base is really, really powerful. And I don't think a lot of developers see that. I think a lot of people just jump into like a ChatGPT or Claude and try and just brute force their way to a solution. And I don't think that's the right approach. I would love to see more folks take a measured approach at this and really make it the small incremental improvements, and you get a lot of win there.
Is that the topic of your talk? Are you going to talk about that?
I'm going to take five of the current developer tools like that and compare them. I'm going to basically
That's cool. You need to send me the slides. I really want to check it out because with this, I recently just had a conversation with like a journalist who wanted to know about these things and wrote down some of the thoughts, and it actually really mirrored what you all have been saying. So
yeah,
I want to look deeper into this.
Yeah, because some of them have superpowers that are different than the others, and I don't think folks understand that either. Like for example, the Goose. No, it's Goose. Goose is very Git aware. No, I'm sorry, take that back. AiderChat. Even in my brain, they don't say straight. AiderChat is very Git aware, and it uses it as its undo function. And like, it's very deeply, like the prompting that they put into it understands Git really, really well, which means it can quickly discern like what's going on in a code base, because it basically does a mapping of your repository structure and then uses that to know when to pull stuff in. I'm super positive and pro on this stuff. And the fact that Aider can use local models mixed in with anything else you want to pull in there, it's really flexible. You're not tied to like some, you know, AWS or Google or OpenAI or Anthropic.
I'm also interested in this. Are you going to be recording that talk or streaming?
Oh yeah, it'll be recorded and it'll be streamed. We'll have good. It online.
So I can go back to YouTube and watch it there. Like I do not have to.
Or you all can join and ask great questions.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah. Sound just super.
IndiePy.org. A little plug for I'm a co-organizer, co-founder of IndiePy, the local Python group here too.
In Indianapolis.
Yeah.
In Indiana. Yep. I would say, well, for me, I've definitely gone on a journey through all of this stuff. When I first saw it, I still to this day feel like LLMs probably border on copyright theft. So I'm a little displeased with them. Well, maybe a lot displeased. But what are you gonna? At the same time, that horse is out of the barn. It's not coming home. It's gone, right? And so then you got to say, well, now what are we gonna do? Am I going to just pretend this doesn't exist because I'm a little bit put off by that? When everyone else is using it to create libraries, tools, applications, content, et cetera, you know, that's not that reasonable either, right? You kind of, to Richard's comment about the productivity, right? You got to be practical. And I also found them to be fairly, like, mind-blowingly cool, but somewhat inaccurate. But that's kind of like a 2023, 2024 version. Yeah. Now, if you get to the higher level models, they are so good. They are so powerful and so effective that it's, if you stopped messing with them a year ago because you don't want to, because you thought they're not really that accurate, I would encourage people to look at it again and maybe look at Calvin's talk. And then Gina, for your concerns, I also share those. Although I definitely have a ChatGPT subscription these days, check out stuff like LM Studio and other ways of running it local, right? Like you can avoid a lot of the melting the power grid.
I mean, then I'm paying for the energy cost. That's also a problem.
Yeah, but it's not that. It's not. You can run lower models that take not much time. You know,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, the most energy cost is training.
Yeah, the Apple Silicon is so efficient. Efficient relatively to everything else out there is so efficient.
Yeah, and we haven't gotten to optimized yet, right? Like
no, yeah, the you're
MPU
right.
MPU is still in its infancy.
Yeah, this is in 5 years. This is going to be. The local models, especially, I think, are going to be really much more capable. We saw DeepSeek already.
And this is driving innovation around abundance. I think we're going to have new solutions to these energy problems, new solutions to the cooling problems. Like they, we can't continue obviously down this route. I do share Gina's concern, but again, I think I come at it with a very optimistic, maybe overly optimistic view. Maybe I wish I was a little more realistic about it. I think Gina is right that there is a problem that has to get addressed.
Yeah, but also we are coming out of this hype. You know, we're kind of at I don't know what the Gartner cycle is calling it again, but like I call it the post-hype hangover, sort of we're in that phase. And I think then, you know, there's going to be a more reasonable mindset. Or like I've always been advocating for smaller models, more task-specific models, using these large generative models to create systems rather than as systems. Like using them as systems is that's kind of 2023. Like what we're doing now is using them to help us write code, but also using them to create data for smaller models, which is totally possible. And that's not old NLP. That's just next level.
Sorry. Maybe to not only say something negative about that, also maybe something positive from my side about that stuff. So I find it very interesting. And I think there are some great tools or going to be some great tools there utilizing this technology. But only if the person using it is actually able to determine whether that stuff it is outputting is actually good.
Yeah.
Only if it is... It doesn't necessarily have to run locally, at least not for me, because I am developing open source anyhow. So everything I do is going to be out in the open anyhow. But some privacy aspects are also something that are to be considered. So local would be nice. Lower energy costs. And please allow me to disable this stuff when I don't want to use it.
Yeah.
Because like... I don't want to have every single tool start waving at me all the time going, hey, by the way, you can also now use my chatbot interface, when I'm like, no, I'm just happy if you list my files here, dear file listener, file lister, something like that. You know, the other day I was looking for a new terminal and found stuff that had, that was also having like trying to tell me that it has AI in it, whatever they meant with that, but I don't need a chatbot interface when I'm trying to write bash. So thank you very much. So give me an off switch, allow me to run this stuff locally, and don't shove it down my throat, and also don't try to plaster it all over the place as the solution for every single problem, especially for people who don't fully understand the problem space yet, because then we also get, like in the open source situation, we also get a lot of issues now generated with AI, security tickets generated by AI, like suggestions from people to help other people generated by AI that are completely wrong and are causing more problems than anything. So if all of this stuff stops, then yes, then I will take another look. But until then, I'm just fed up to here with that, and I can't stand it anymore.
No, I agree. I mean, I work very closely in the space, and I absolutely agree with your points. Yeah.
All right, everyone. I think we're just getting started. We could go for a very long time, but we also are out of time. Cool. Enos, Gina, Richard, Calvin, thank you all for being here. It's been a lot of fun.
Likewise. Thanks, thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Bye, all.
This has been another episode of Talk Python to Me. Thank you to our sponsors. Be sure to check out what they're offering. It really helps support the show. This episode is brought to you by NordLayer. NordLayer is a toggle-ready network security platform built for modern businesses. It combines VPN, access control, and threat protection in one easy-to-use platform. Visit talkpython.fm/NordLayer and remember to use the code talkpython-10. And it's brought to you by Auth0. Auth0 is an easy-to-implement, adaptable authentication and authorization platform. Think easy user logins, social sign-on, multi-factor authentication, and robust role-based access control. With over 30 SDKs and quick starts, Auth0 scales with your product at every stage. Get 25,000 monthly active users for free at talkpython.fm/Auth0. Want to level up your Python? We have one of the largest catalogs of Python video courses over at TalkPython. Our content ranges from true beginners to deeply advanced topics like memory and async. And best of all, there's not a subscription in sight. Check it out for yourself at training.talkpython.fm. Be sure to subscribe to the show. Open your favorite podcast app and search for Python. We should be right at the top. You can also find the iTunes feed at /iTunes, the Google Play feed at /play, and the direct RSS feed at /RSS on talkpython.fm. We're live streaming most of our recordings these days. If you want to be part of the show and have your comments featured on the air, Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at talkpython.fm/YouTube. This is your host, Michael Kennedy. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Now get out there and write some Python code.